Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your skiff of podcasty sanity in an ocean of turbulent madness. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Hi, friendies.
Happy New Year.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
New Year?
Yeah.
Oh, New Year. Got it.
It's 5783, baby.
That's cool.
Somehow we got past that Zager and Evans 25-25 without a...
As long as you're alive, we will
incident.
Never get past that.
Next. What I want to know is, yeah, what's the star true. Date?
There probably is someone who could answer that who's listening to this podcast right now.
Or who's actually a participant. We're going to take a long look at the mixed up, shook up world that we live in a moment. But first, 20 years ago, a guy named Jack, frustrated with his ADHD and the insufficiency of Adderall in helping overcome energy crashes, mood swings, brain fog, and stomach pain, developed a product called Functional Coffee that now has more than 20,000 monthly subscribers to help them get more healthily through their day. Now Jack's back with a mushroom-based coffee called Everyday Dose, not the Nick Gillespie type of mushrooms, but just mushrooms. Everyday Dose is the healthiest and most convenient alternative to traditional coffee, giving you energy and focus without making you irritable or ripping up your guts. It still gives you caffeine, still tastes like coffee. You can try Everyday Dose's delicious, better-for-you coffee without the jitters, crash, or digestive issues by going to www.everydaydose.com. It's absolutely risk-free. 60-day money-back guarantee. Go to everydaydose.com and start thinking different about your morning routine. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. Yes.
Matt,
yes.
Can I just point out that I start my morning with Everyday Dose. Non-psychoactive mushroom coffee alternative. It's delicious.
That's the kind of testimonial that we need here at the Reason Roundtable podcast. All right, I'm going to take a sip of my coffee, look deeply into the eyes of my colleagues, and commence. The world is kind of going through a moment, people. You have brave female protesters and deadly regime crackdowns all over Iran. Italy just became the second country in Europe this month to elect a populist right-wing government. The British pound is crashing. The stock market here ain't exactly a picnic. China continues to do all kinds of China things towards Taiwan. Hurricane Ian is ripping through the Caribbean and headed for Florida. And oh yeah, Russia and the United States are warning one another about thermonuclear war. So Russia is where we'll start this show. Last week, Vladimir Putin announced that he was mobilizing an additional 300,000 reservists in the wake of mass battlefield setbacks in Ukraine, and said in a deranged speech that he'd be willing to use nuclear weapons against anyone trying to dislodge him from Crimea and the Donbas. The draft triggered unusual amounts of protests and street clashes all across Russia. An ongoing exodus among military-age males who are able to flee the country, those who can, that is. Putin also staged bogus referenda across occupied Ukraine over the weekend to make it seem like the population wants to keep his troops there. President Joe Biden said in a speech last week to the United Nations General Assembly, quote, "Ukraine has the same rights that belong to every sovereign nation. We will stand in solidarity with Ukraine. We will stand in solidarity against Russia's aggression, period. Because if nations can pursue their imperial ambitions without consequences, then we put at risk everything this very institution stands for, period, everything." Catherine, the U.S. is spending just the vast amounts of the money being sent to Ukraine in terms of money and weapons. Are you okay with the U.S. being the arsenal for Ukraine's sovereignty here at $67 billion and counting?
I think that there are going to be consequences to that. And we are now staring down the barrel of them, maybe kind of literally. All the Sunday shows were full of national security types using adjectives, which I thought was interesting. So we had National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan on Meet the Press saying that if Russia crosses the line, there will be catastrophic consequences and the U.S. will respond decisively. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken said that the consequences would be horrific. And then they kind of say, like, And those guys know what we mean. We told them privately exactly what those adjectives mean. I would be interested for the American people to know what those adjectives mean, because it matters to us. And yes, we have gotten ourselves entangled in this conflict. I understand the arguments for why we ended up where we did. And I think we certainly could have taken a more destructive stance in either direction. But this is, you know, this is the natural consequence, which is that we now have to have a World War III conversation with a madman.
Peter, you wake up every morning with your personal DEFCON somewhere between 3 and 2. Are you at this point just wearing adult diapers, or how is your level of queasiness at the prospect of nuclear annihilation?
This is an incredibly dangerous moment, I think, for America and for the entire world. Nuclear conflict between Russia and the United States. Like, you kind of have to say this, even though it's obvious. If we started launching nuclear weapons at each other, that would end civilization as we know it. This isn't hundreds dead. This isn't thousands. This is, at the bare minimum, hundreds of thousands and probably millions and millions of people dead in a matter of minutes. And we are inching closer and closer toward a potential nuclear conflict between Russia and the West, and the United States in particular. And I think, in a way, people are a little bit too calm about it. Now, I am not counseling that people freak out, that people, you know, panic, that they, you know, go run off to a bunker somewhere. At the same time, this is very concerning, and I am worried that our foreign policy leaders, that folks in Washington who actually have some direct control over this, are underestimating the risks of nuclear conflict here. And in some ways, I think they've been underestimating the risks of nuclear conflict from the beginning of Russia's aggression into Ukraine. Now, it is obviously true, as I've said on this podcast before, that Russia is deeply in the wrong here, and Ukraine's cause is just, and you have to root for them. At the same time, Ukraine's incentive, what is good for Ukraine, is not necessarily good for the United States and for the rest of the world. And arming Ukraine and becoming a partner in Ukraine's war in Russia's war on Ukraine, in the Ukraine conflict with Russia. If that goes well, then what happens is Russia feels backed into a corner, and Putin ends up being more likely, I think, in that circumstance, to use nuclear weapons. And so this Biden's decision from the beginning to maximally back Ukraine has led to a point where, in some ways, there is a good outcome, which is that Ukraine seems to be doing surprisingly well. And you have to cheer for that in some ways. And in other ways, there is a very bad outcome, which is that the world has taken further steps towards nuclear conflict between great powers in a way that could be literally civilization ending.
Nick, your golfing buddy, Tucker Carlson, says, and a lot of national conservatives,
also cocaine snorting. But
I didn't want to. Well, I thought that
statute of limitations.
So that comes before the golf usually.
It helps get through those links a little quicker.
It's like a 45-minute 9-hole round. It's I think it's going to become standard.
When not predicting Russia's imminent victory, Carlson has been saying, and a lot of his guests and a lot of national conservatives in America have been saying, this war only ends when America sits down with Russia to negotiate a settlement. Do you agree with that assessment?
No, and that shows, you know, the problem, whether it's right wingers or left wingers. If you are going to insist that every war everywhere is ultimately about the U.S. either providing the table or sitting down at the table or strong-arming people, you know, you're doing it wrong. Biden's foreign policy is disastrous. I'm not worried about nuclear war. You know, Putin has too many billions of dollars that he has secreted all over the globe. He is not going to blow that up. He's not going to blow up things before he gets a chance to spend it as like a leader in exile or, you know, a great warlord who, you know, steps down munificently at the end of his administration. What the world diplomatic community, including the U.S., which, and I agree with what both Peter and Catherine were saying, that we're brokered or compromised by the fact that we are actively aiding one side of this war in a way that I don't think we should be, even as I agree that, you know, Ukraine is the aggrieved party here. But this is why Europeans should be in charge of their continent and their foreign policy, and they should be dealing with this. The U.S. and other people in the world, international community, can be coming up with a settlement that will work to de-escalate this conflict. That's what we should be doing. Maybe the Biden administration is doing that. It's unclear, you know, that they are. In between this and, you know, tensions in Iran and elsewhere, they don't inspire any confidence whatsoever. You know, so that's problematic. But I'm not worried about the nuclear exchange. And I actually, you know, I'm feeling optimistic as long as we're just pulling, you know, vibes out of our various orifices. I'm feeling incredibly optimistic.
Nick, I take your point about not every conflict has to be about the United States. At the same time, this one very much has to be about the United States, because the United States government has chosen to enter into it as a participant with tens of billions of dollars of aid and weaponry.
There's a difference between, you know, and I mean, I don't think we should have done that.
I know you don't think we should have done that, but we did, and so now we are a partner in Ukraine's conflict. That's
the ultimate sunk cost fallacy then. Saying, like, because we made a misstep going in, we've got to be in.
I am not saying we have to be there in the end, but I am saying that the United States is now part of this, whether we like it or not, and now we have decisions to make going forward about how we are going to comport ourselves.
I would agree. I would just say, you know, like our efforts and those, you know, the United Nations obviously is a waste, and NATO, you know, continues to unimpress. But all efforts should be towards figuring out a way to end this now or as quickly as possible, because Ukraine has won effectively. And that sends a massive message to China and to other superpowers, including the U.S. Like, don't think that you're very good at invading and occupying other countries. You know, but we should be working to end this now in a way that allows Putin or whoever to save face and to, you know, retreat.
I should remind people, because it's just to back up on Nick's sunk cost fallacy point in foreign policy, that is where the directions usually traverse. You might recall Howard Dean rose to national prominence running in the 2004 Democratic presidential primaries.
Is that what you said?
being the anti-war guy. His idea was to increase the number of U.S. troops in Iraq to 500,000. He was the anti-war guy. Because he said, we've screwed up the war, but since we're there, we got to, like, do it right and, like, then bring everybody home. So, like, it naturally goes in that direction. Catherine, Volodymyr Zelensky also addressed the United Nations last week, as did most everybody. And he said no settlement can include a drop of land. I think that was what he said. A drop of land of Ukraine ceding to Russia. We will get back all of our territory. Russia has to leave, which makes it seem like we're going to be in, they're going to be in a war for a long time. Is there an upside to the notion of his in that sense, and also in Biden underscoring in his speech? Is there an upside in a kind of the reassertion of the notion of sovereignty of individual, smaller-ish, less powerful nations being more secure and kind of righteous in fighting for their own territory?
I think at the highest level, there's some appeal to that. But I also think the best read on this is simply a practical one, right? It's like the first page of a textbook about how to do negotiations is you start out with the biggest possible ask. You start out with the strongest possible claim, and you don't give until you absolutely have to. And Zelensky and Ukraine don't feel they're in a place where they have to give yet. And the reason they don't feel they're in a place where they have to give yet is because the United States keeps sending them a lot of money and a lot of guns. I think those things are very, very closely related. And, to Nick and Peter's point earlier, in that sense, we have enabled that stance, right? The United States government has enabled Zelensky to say, we will not give one drop of land. And depending on your lens on this, that's exactly what we wanted to enable. We wanted to enable territorial sovereignty, robust claims against a mad tyrant. Or we have further delayed the inevitable compromise with the massive power that is Russia. And in so doing, caused, a global conversation about whether nuclear arms are going to be used.
Nick, what's going to happen to poor Rod Dreher and Pat Buchanan, those people?
They're going to maybe join Hans Hermann Hoppe in exile in Turkey or Hungary, I hope. And they can start a Club Med for muscular men or something together, who are upholding the finest elements of Western civilization, mostly by, taking on Oriental versions of Christianity and supporting that.
Thank you. That's a very succinct and accurate answer. Let's actually move on because that makes me laugh. As mentioned previously at the top of the show, Iran has seen 10 days of angry, furious protests across at least 46 cities after the Islamic Morality Police killed a 22-year-old woman named Mahsa Amini, who had been arrested for wearing her headscarf too loosely. An estimated 35 protesters and a half a dozen pro-regime paramilitary members have been killed in these subsequent clashes. Conflict comes against the backdrop of Ayatollah Khomeini, the country's 83-year-old supreme leader, falling ill, triggering speculation about succession and so forth. Catherine, how has your lady robot heart been taking in these protests, seeing a just incredibly righteous and brave response against a dictatorship?
Yeah, there's one little clip I saw of a woman with her headscarf off, and she's pulling her hair back into that, oh, now I fucking mean business ponytail. You know the ponytail that I'm talking about, where you like do the ponytail, but then you kind of leave the tail sucked in because you can't have the ponytail be flapping around while you're about to take care of business. And I have to say, like, that reached my lady robot heart. I was like, oh my God, they got the ponytail and I ran. So I for sure had that moment. I, of course, as a robot in the end, deeply distrust my own tribalist sentiment in favor of women here, just as I deeply distrust America's tribalist sentiment in favor of Ukraine in some ways. The people being oppressed, we identify with them in some way. It makes us see more justice in their cause. That said, there's a lot of justice in that cause, a heck of a lot of justice. And the other thing I've been thinking about with respect to what's going on in Iran is, it's the libertarian cliche, like, don't make a law unless you're willing to kill someone to enforce it. And in this case, the law that they were willing to kill someone to enforce was your hair poking out of your scarf. And they're totally willing to do that in Iran. But that tells us what we need to know about that regime, that they're going to stand by that result, and not that the powers that be and also the people in general are just totally horrified by it. I think the protests are a good sign. I think that, we can talk a little bit if we have more time about the kind of censorship and internet access angles that are going on there. But mostly I'm just feeling ponytail solidarity.
Peter, let's talk about that internet censorship stuff. I see Elon Musk being hailed, Catherine's sexy South African boyfriend, Elon Musk, being hailed as a hero for
billionaire side piece
for hooking up Starlink or Iran to Starlink system.
Starlink, Skynet, whatever.
He was not allowed to do previously because of U.S. sanctions. So the U.S. is tightening some sanctions against Iran in the wake of protests, removing some sanctions. What's your assessment of the tech link and also kind of sanctions approach from the U.S.?
I think it's good that Elon Musk is setting up Starlink internet access. I think it's always a good thing when, private actors who have some influence and power can check authoritarian governments. And this is, I think, one of the We have this terrible discourse in the United States about how billionaires are terrible, and it's very bad that like single individuals in the private sector have all of this power, and like maybe there should be no billionaires because it's unfair, and we shouldn't even really have charity. It should all go through the government, and everything should be done in the public sector. And no, this is one of the reasons why it's actually a very good thing when an individual in the private sphere has a huge amount of resources and power to be able to deploy, is because that can aid the cause of human freedom, and it can aid justice. And I think in this case, that is what's happening. Even if it doesn't ultimately have a huge direct impact, it is in service of a cause that is just, and it shows how, in fact, having multiple competing power centers that aren't just the government is in fact a good thing. And in fact, you know, if I would like to bring this back to Russia, if I were to compare the two power centers here, the two United States power centers that we're talking about, Elon Musk and the federal government, there is a case to be made that Elon Musk is more in the right here in what he's doing with Starlink than Joe Biden's aid to Ukraine. Again, noting that I think that Ukraine's cause is just and that Russia is deeply in the wrong, but Joe Biden might end up blowing this and getting the world into a nuclear conflict. And Elon Musk is going to give people internet and allow them to talk to each other and allow them to better fight back on their own against an authoritarian regime.
Nick, we have been through this rodeo before when it comes to social media optimism about the bravery of people in Tehran. To Catherine's point, are you finding yourself kind of distrusting whatever kind of positive vibes that you're feeling over there across the East River from me?
No, because ultimately this is, you know, the Iranian regime is not going to be overthrown because of social media. And if you go back to, the Green Revolution and whatnot, I mean, there's no question that the internet, allows for different and better communication. I think the Starlink talk is overhyped because that requires hardware that is not in place in Iran and things like that. But my larger point is, it's Twitter didn't cause the Arab Spring, any more than, horses and the, committees of correspondence caused the American Revolution. They help enable it and sometimes push it forward or hold it back. But what is going to happen in Iran is that the people there are going to overthrow a dictatorial regime. And it's going to take, it might take longer, it might take shorter, but they are inching towards this decade by decade. When I was looking at the footage of this and the cause of all of this stuff, it's mind numbing. Because this is what the regime ultimately cares about, right? This is where they're going to stake their legitimacy on a fucking hijab, which, they reintroduced in an insane way as their power decreases over time and they get more and more draconian. It's like the end of apartheid. The last 20 years of apartheid were far worse than the first 20 years of apartheid because the regime knows its days are numbered. And the Iranian regime is a theocratic, if we think our leaders are old and out of touch, Iran, has got us beat by, a decade on average and things like that. So, this is the type of thing where the U.S. shouldn't be intervening. And in fact, it has to step back and allow this to happen from within Iran for it to be legitimate. And it is painful. And the best types of things we can be doing are allowing as many refugees and enabling people to escape and to flee and to speak out from outside the country as, more than trying to get involved in the internal disputes.
Sadly, our refugee intake system in this country has been pretty fakakta, that's a word, right? For the last 5-6 years, showing a very little sign of improving, as have a lot of our sanctions regime. This has been true with Iran for a long time. It's true with Cuba and other places because of our heightened interest in the and history of meddling in the policies of those countries, we issue such tight sanctions against them that it ends up quashing the ability of people to communicate with exile communities abroad, and then also internal communications. Some of the ultimate in bass ackwards American U.S. foreign policy over the years have been precisely in those places.
If I may, here's a counterfactual. If we had not invaded Iraq for absolutely no legitimate reason in 2003, the Iranian regime would have already been over. In 2002, and there were massive demonstrations against the regime, and the thing that ended those completely was the American invasion of Iraq, which then, created a totally different, context for how things work in Iran. And, the 21st century has been an object lesson in understanding how American foreign policy has been a failure. And it would be great if we would actually start abstracting those lessons and applying them, as opposed to constantly, dumbly and, in ever dumb ways, kind of recapitulating them. Biden, it's not like any of the presidents in the 21st century have been good on foreign policy, but he is kind of spectacularly bad. And this is something that he really needs, or, him and the blob or whatever it is, need to be held accountable. They are constantly blundering into stupid situations and making them worse.
I would not defend Biden, but just point out that at least he, unlike his predecessors, got us out of Afghanistan very badly, but he got us out of Afghanistan, which is something that Donald Trump had been talking about for a long time. And even in the escalation in Russia, there hasn't been talk except, when he sort of blundered into it at, was it the State of the Union address? It might have been of like regime change.
Oops, just accidentally
in Moscow.
Said it. Yeah.
Yeah. Whoops. So, he's got old man disease. Yes, go, Catherine.
Yeah. I just wanted to toss in one more thing about the sanctions in Iran, because there's actually the twist on the Starlink stuff. So technically Starlink, Musk making Starlink available in Iran was in violation of the sanctions that were in place. So he had to petition the Treasury Department to give him permission to do that. And Nick is quite right that actually it's mostly symbolic at this point because they don't have the hardware. Interestingly, the people who do have the hardware is Ukraine. There's a ton of these Starlink terminals in Ukraine now. And so in theory, some of those could make their way into Iran. That would be an interesting way to tie together the first half of this podcast, among other things. But the foreign ministry
always
in Iran...
looking for thematic unity.
I'm here for it. The foreign ministry in Iran last week called the U.S. rolling back some of those sanctions in order to allow Musk to enable Starlink a violation of Iran's sovereignty. So we are now in this absolutely insane world of our own making, where undoing some of the sanctions that have so long been in place and so ineffectively been in place, the foreign ministry is like, how dare you? And I think that does go to show that we are, we are entangled in every conflict. We are part of every battle. Whether it's money, whether it's sanctions, we truly are still very much the world's policeman. And that getting out of Afghanistan was a huge step, but it's so small in comparison to how just excruciatingly a part of every single conflict the U.S. has chosen to be.
A final note of thematic unity. To Nick's point of counterfactual about the U.S. invasion of Iraq and how absolutely destabilizing and disastrous that was, the very notion of international sovereignty was underscored and defended in a press conference in the fall of 1990 with Mikhail Gorbachev and George H.W. Bush after Iraq invaded Kuwait. And they said in this new world order, they used that phrase, sorry, we should uphold the right of sovereignty of nations to not get invaded by their neighbors. So we were bedfellows on that, went to the first Gulf War on that theory, regardless of what you think about it. And then for basically the next three decades, the U.S., especially in Iraq, degraded that notion of sovereignty, first by enforcing no-fly zones over half the country, eventually going through war and all this kind of stuff. And that degradation of sovereignty definitely helped soften the terrain for Vladimir Putin's 2014 annexation of Crimea. And that's your history lesson. Thank you. We're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, look, we're all responsible adults here. We do what it takes to ensure our families in case of medical emergency. But what many of us don't realize is that health insurance won't always cover the full cost of an emergency medical flight. Even comprehensive coverage can leave you with high deductibles and copays. That's where AirMed Care Network comes in. When you sign up to become a member, should any such emergency arise, you will not see a bill for air medical transport when flown by an AMCN provider. AirMed Care flying machines transport more than 100,000 patients each year. Best of all, this peace of mind for your whole family can be yours, beginning at the low, low price of just $85 a year. But wait, listeners to the Roundtable can get gift cards with their new membership for up to $50 American. Through either Visa or Amazon gift card, simply visit airmedcarenetwork.com/reason. Use the offer code REASON and start protecting your family. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, reminder to email your brief queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Ben. I think I can pronounce that, who writes, hello, it's belated by almost a couple of months, but the CIA turned 75 on July 26th. By the way, that's my 25th anniversary. So I got married to the CIA. Is there a libertarian argument in favor of having a central intelligence agency? And if yes, how closely would a libertarian approved CIA resemble the one we have now? Thanks, Ben. Catherine, in your anarchy-topia, what do you call it?
Anarchapoco.
In your own personal anarchapoco, Catherine, do you have a CIA?
In the anarchapoco of my mind, yeah.
Yes.
No, there's no CIA because there's no anything, and I don't really know how to say that differently again. But we just, like, if there's no government, there's definitely no CIA. Would there be intelligence gathering? Yeah. Would that intelligence gathering be sometimes for, let's say, like philanthropic purposes and sometimes for self-defense purposes of various groups of people? Yes. So, yes, I think that, I mean, corporate espionage exists, right? This is a function that people tend to do, regardless of whether or not the government is doing it. But I think the CIA has not covered itself in libertarian glory, guys. And I can't really imagine what a libertarian CIA looks like. I guess I defer to you, my statist colleagues, to paint that picture, but I can't see it myself.
Peter, you're the statist. What's your libertarian CIA look like?
So, sadly, Catherine has not read Ian M. Banks's Culture series, although she might have read my essay on the books from the magazine a couple of years ago. In the Culture, Ian M. Banks wrote a series of novels that take place very far into the future in a sort of quasi-anarchist a kind of interplanetary situation in which there are some governments, like, sort of locally located, but like there's most of civilization is just sort of part of what's called the culture, or like the primary civilization, I should say, that we cover is this sort of anarchist collective called the culture that doesn't really have a government, and also they're post-singularity, so they have unlimited resources. AI minds just sort of manage everything for everyone, and you can kind of live forever as a man or a woman or a whale or all three if you want, and do whatever you want. And in this world where there is no real government, no real resource limitations, and like people and creatures and minds are all pretty committed to a kind of libertarian anarchist principle of nonviolence. In this world, there is an organization called Special Circumstances, or SC. And SC is very much the CIA of the culture. So even in this anarchist utopia, they have something like the CIA. And Special Circumstances is a sort of ad hoc group, mostly of these AI minds that come together to solve problems. And in particular, they solve difficult problems of foreign entanglement with non-utopian, peaceful anarchist societies, because they do occasionally run into these societies where they're still dictatorial, still authoritarian, and they have to deal with them somehow or another. And they can't deal with them in the normal way of just like negotiating stuff. between two people, like everything happens with inside the culture. So they have to have a system for it. But it's ad hoc. It's not really totally an official organization. And also because Ian M. Banks was a pretty devoted, like loud critic of foreign intervention, even in this beautiful anarchist futuristic society where like there's no real problems, SC, Special Circumstances, kind of gets it wrong. And a lot of his stories are about parables about the dangers of foreign intervention. And so I think,
just heard a lot of words. And what I heard in the end was you saying, Catherine's right. There's no such thing as a libertarian or anarchist.
What I'm saying is, in our libertarian anarchist utopia, there might still be one and it might still be making mistakes.
Nick, you've been trying to live like a whale for the last 75 years.
I don't know what that means.
I was just checking to see whether you listened to Peter's answer, and the answer is no.
I went out to the post office and was mailing a care package to the Donbass region.
If I'm not mistaken, the 1980 Libertarian Party ticket, including a vice presidential candidate, David Koch, campaigned on abolishing the CIA. So why are you a Koch show?
And the FBI and the NSA. Yeah, I feel like they didn't go far enough.
Yeah, okay. So what's Nick Gillespie's relationship with the CIA? What's your daddy issues with it?
First, I want to say that the CIA did fund Encounter magazine, which was founded in 1953 and was headed up by Stephen Spender, the British poet and writer, and Irving Kristol, and they produced a ton of great cultural and literary criticism. So, you know, they've got that.
Hats off.
Operation Condor. The space program got us Tang, like no deal.
Yeah, but that's not true.
I know, it is. That's
Tang
true. That's a lie.
Before,
yeah,
so.
And they didn't eat
Velcro also.
And they didn't eat astronaut ice cream in space. It's the triple whammy of lies.
And we and if we're being truth tellers, and we are, you know, they didn't go to them. It's all on a backlot. I mean, come on.
They did go.
You know. But Encounter magazine did exist, and it was pretty good. So you got that. You got the failure to predict the end of the Soviet Union or the collapse of the Berlin Wall. You have, more recently in 2014, a pretty damning report about how the CIA abetted torture that not only didn't help us fight the global war on terror, but fucked up our ability to fight the global war on terror. The CIA should be gone. Even internationalists like Daniel Patrick Moynihan in 1991 and 1995 introduced legislation to just abolish the CIA. And this is a guy who, you know, made his bones or got to being a senator by being, you know, a member or ambassador to the or whatever delegate to the United Nations. He's a committed internationalist. And if somebody like that is saying, fucking get rid of this organization, it's time to take it seriously. You know, it's not just people like Ed Clark and David Koch in 1980 and libertarians and stuff like that. George Marshall, World War II commander as well as statesman, who the John Birch Society hilariously called an agent of the Soviet Union in one of their communist fever dreams, also thought that the CIA should never have existed. All of its functions can be folded into the State Department, where they would be fucked up and stupid, but also more visible, transparent, and subordinated to legislative oversight, which is the point. So, no, there would not be a CIA in the libertarian, in a libertarian world.
I think you're always going to have an intelligence agency, people doing spy craft secretly, listening in on people, having double agents, the whole bit is
people insisting that, don't you see, it's just a game.
Yes.
We're not going to get rid of that as much as we want to.
Guys in weird hats sitting on park benches in East Coast cities, all of that's going to happen.
Dead drops.
We just want that to be like a polycentric playgrounds. Order of guys in weird hats, though, right? Like we want like more loyalties that are
you
more
mean like a libertarian convention?
Yeah.
Okay. God,
we want the spies to be wearing anonymous masks.
I think one of the problems, even with statists, is that you have a culture issue with the CIA. You just have a history of meddling in the internal affairs of other countries, toppling governments, assassinating people, operating black sites for torture.
Failing to assassinate people, too. I mean, that's the other... I mean, like, the CIA is not only evil, they are incompetent at evil. They couldn't
the
fucking
food is
kill
terrible,
Fidel Castro.
And the portions are so small. It really...
Yeah. No, it, I mean, it is, like, mind-numbing when you start to actually consider the CIA with anything like a critical lens. It's like,
yeah, you gotta start that thing over. And in American governance, especially right now at a time when no one wants to stop anything except their political opponents, there isn't going to be a lot of support for that, sadly. It needs to happen. The CIA has been operating on an undisclosed budget for its entire existence. That's ridiculous. That doesn't belong in any kind of... You can still fund the whole thing and say, yep, costs $87.2 billion a year or whatever it is. That's the bare minimum of democratic legitimacy. We don't even have that. It's an agency that operates in a vacuum of accountability. And what happens when you give people unaccountable power? What happens? Let me think. And if that power becomes absolute, then what happens? So... yeah, screw the CIA, even for those of us who like spies and spying, because they think it's kind of weird and cool and fun. All right. On Wednesday of this past week, New York State Attorney General Tish James, announced that her office would be filing a civil lawsuit against the Trump Organization, which is the nonprofit associated with the former president, and three
A corporate nonprofit criminal organization, Matt Welch.
Three of his four kids, or three of his least four kids, whatever, you know what I mean, are all going to be part of this $250 million a lawsuit. She said they violated several state criminal laws, including falsifying business records, issuing false financial statements, insurance fraud, engaging in a conspiracy to commit. They're always a conspiracy with these people. Basically, it all comes down to the falsely inflated his net worth by billions of dollars to unjustly enrich himself and to cheat the system, etc. This led a lot of people to get out their toy cannons and say, finally, this is the big one. Catherine, what do we think about Tish James and finally getting Donald Trump?
I have totally given up hope that there is some finally getting of Donald Trump. We've talked about this on this podcast before. Everybody always thinks they have the thing that's finally going to bring him down, either legally or in the eyes of his supporters. They almost certainly don't have the thing. Everyone knows that Donald Trump lies about his net worth. That is like kind of his brand. That's kind of his whole jam, is lying about his net worth. Yes, I understand in this case they are seeking sort of this very narrow, specific way of making those lies legally actionable. I think the worst part about all of this is that Trump has probably correctly noted that because this, he said, I never thought this case would be brought until I saw her really bad poll numbers, he said, referring to her James's reelection race. She's a fraud who campaigned on a Get Trump platform. And, he notes that if her opponent wins, that this might well go away, and that's basically his strategy. That's probably true. And that sucks all around. It's definitely political. And regardless of whether I think that the political outcome of Donald Trump not being able to run for office again, or for Trump or his children to not, I think, sit on boards in New York would be one of the consequences if this went through, I think he's probably somewhat right about the motivations, and that, as always, muddies the waters.
Peter, building on that point, Tish James sent out a fundraising email the same day. It said, guess who's in the headlines again? And then once again, this is reading from the email, once again, powerful and corrupt men have taken over the headlines, friend. But I'm not surprised. Ever since I took my oath as your attorney general and swore to do everything in my power to finally bring the most corrupt actors to justice, they have worked tirelessly, italicized, to take me down. I know you don't like Trump very much, Peter. Does this type of kind of rank political monetization undermine the very sense of impartiality of the law that we should be wanting to use in, I don't know, doing things like prosecute Donald Trump?
Yes, I think it does. I think it's unfortunate. And, you know, to relate this to something else we talk on the about on the podcast every now and then, the Supreme Court, John Roberts, as the Chief Justice, has spent the last decade or so really striving, I think in some cases failing, to maintain at least some sort of pretense of like nonpartisan balance and legitimacy to say this isn't purely political, that we are actually just trying to, you know, interpret the law here. And there's a reason for that, because when it's really obvious that that's not what you're doing, then that deforms and degrades the law and makes the law less powerful. And what we should want is a fair and nonpartisan exercise of power when it comes to justice. And I just don't see that that's what's happening here. I think it is quite probable that that Trump lied, possibly even in legally actionable ways, about the values of his properties. At the same time, how many companies, especially sort of shambolic, bizarre companies like the one that Donald Trump has been running, how many companies could stand for years and years of intensely politically motivated rummaging through their books, like, and not find something that was like, eh, that's actually, that's probably not legal? Because when you have, I mean, when you have, even if he is inflating his net worth, there's a huge amount of money that runs through the Trump organizations and Trump world and Trump various Trump brands. It's not, you know, it's not 10 bucks a year. This isn't even, it's not a Substack, man. This is, it's a ton of money. And that money gets moved around and recorded and in ways that may or may not be perfectly legal. And I just think that, again, I don't trust Trump. I think he's a liar. I think he is, in the colloquial phrasing, a fraudster. But I don't like the way this prosecution has been, you know, has been engaged in. And just the overt political nature of it, I think, really undermines the case.
Nick, for thematic unity reasons, if nothing else, would you agree that the kind of political nonprofit sector, in terms of accountability and skullduggery, is basically the CIA of the philanthropy world?
No, it's the special circumstances. It's the E&M Bank science fiction organization. And somebody's going to turn into a whale here, and it might be me.
I'm going to get some Philip K. Dick in me and try
diaper wearing goats driving in the Jose Canseco car.
Lasers.
Kill pink Peter lasers into your brain, Nick, right now.
I was trying to come up with a baseball metaphor, Matt, of how like the CIA, it's, you know, it gets revamped, but it's kind of like the Washington Senators, you know, coming back and becoming a new franchise, but not really. And, you know, and so you got to get to the Nationals, like a truly a different franchise that's not rooted in the Senators, in order to get to a World Series championship. And I don't
even
know where that's
going,
but I don't know where this
conversation is. Even I can tell that metaphor didn't work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What, that metaphor was broken upon the wheel, like Matt Welch and a beautiful butterfly or a Disney princess. I don't know. I'm stroking out here. Matt, the important thing about this story, I think, is that everybody gets that, you know, Trump is a fraudster, as Peter puts it, and Letitia James is a fake and just an opportunist. And what I take away from this story, and I don't think the details matter, it's that nobody really gives a shit. Everybody knows this is kind of like a repetition compulsion, and it's not generating juice or anything. Even loyalists on both sides are kind of like, yeah, whatever. I mean, this is like, you know, if Trump was Happy Days, this is the moment before they're like, okay, if we're going to squeeze another season out of this, we got to open a dude ranch in California or go into outer space or something like that. This, and that's a good thing. Trump's fascination for us is dying, and I think that's good as a society.
All right, let's get to our end of podcast, what we have all been consuming in the cultural production arena. Catherine Mangu Ward, would you like to kick us off?
I would love to. I read, for the first time, I think in 20 years, a little bit of Benjamin Constant this week. I joined a group of students for Liberty Mostly, the event was hosted by the South Asia chapter, but it was student leaders from around the world. And we did a little discussion on the liberty of ancients compared with that of the moderns. And I gotta say, Constant is good, y'all. Like, very readable. The man makes some good points. Absolutely hilarious stuff where he hand waves away the excesses of the French Revolution. Just A+ all around. Really, really fascinating to discuss that work with student activists from all over the world, because they are in very different stages of their fight for liberty. I mean, we talked just now about women in Iran and what they are facing, but I think it can be easy to get really absorbed in the intricacies of American politics and, you know, the abandonment of these kind of classical liberal principles that we've talked a lot about in this podcast. There are many, many places where they are still fighting to get that stuff for the first time. And Constant's words are genuinely inspiring to them. It's a short essay. It's actually not even an essay. It's a speech that he gave. Save yourself the trouble of reading any of his longer works and just go to the link in the Reason Roundtable recommendations, which does exist on our website for you listeners who might be wondering how they can find all these great tips from us. I'll throw a link in there. Read it and just have a moment to be inspired by one of the great thinkers of liberty.
Nice. Peter, what have you been consuming?
I watched the third season of For All Mankind, the alternate history space race drama on Apple Plus. For those who don't know what the show is about, I'm going to spoil the very first scene of episode one for you. It takes place in NASA's Mission Control Center. And like you can tell, something, a big deal is about to happen. This is the late 1960s. And we see shots of space and the moon. And people are like, is this really happening? And an astronaut steps out onto the moon and speaks Russian. Because the Ruskies beat us. Ooh. And so then it is an alternate history of America that flows from this question of what if the Russians had beaten us to the moon. And so it is it then becomes a kind of social alternate history of America, a lot like Mad Men, actually, in its way, in that it is addressing sort of a bunch of social and cultural and political issues. There's a different succession of presidents. They get into issues such as gay rights and women's rights. In fact, there are female pilots who are brought into the NASA program, in part because the Russians have used female pilots. And Nixon is like, oh, if they're doing it, then we got to get our female pilots up to the moon. Each season.
We just call those pilots, Peter.
But Nixon didn't in the show. So each season.
As long as they're not Jewish, he doesn't care what, you know, how they sit when
they pick. Each season takes place over like a decade and there are big jumps forward in time through each season. So the first season was late 60s and then into the 1970s. The second season, it takes place in the 1980s. And by the 1980s, we already have a moon base, the Jamestown colony, and there's conflict with the Russians up on the moon. And then in the third season, it takes place in the 1990s and it's about the race to Mars. And it's a three-way race between Russia, the NASA, and a private space company. And so they all are trying to get to Mars. And it's just this kind of fascinating, smart, fun. I don't know. It's occasionally silly. It's occasionally frustrating. I think some of the ways the show handles politics, like one of the astronauts eventually ends up in the White House. And like there's a huge political drama over funding NASA in a way that's a little bit like, okay. But the show basically works. The characters are really well drawn. The period details are a lot of fun. It's a show that like doesn't sort of start from the premise in, you know, a contest between the United States, between NASA and a private space company. It doesn't start from the premise that, oh, private space sucks. It's just terrible, right? It seems to, you know, recognize that there are different advantages that the two organizations would have, and that they might, you know, they end up sort of working together, and the Russians end up sort of involved in all of this as well. The show is run by the same guy who did the reboot of Battlestar Galactica, Ronald D. Moore, also a writer on Star Trek The Next Generation and Star Trek Deep Space Nine going back many years. So he has a deep history in science fiction. It's not like the best show I've ever seen, but it's a lot of fun. And if you like space, if you like rockets, and if you like alternate histories of post-war America, it's really interesting. And it's basically an argument that space and the frontier are central to American identity, and that if we'd lost the moon race, we would have a different conception of ourselves.
Nick, what have you been consuming? Who won?
I want to watch that show now, but I also want to ask you, Matt, don't you think it would be great if the reason why we lost the space race is because the Beach Boys released the Smile album as intended, and then it was like, fuck it, why would we leave Southern California?
No, let's just stay here forever.
You know, let's just sing songs about vegetables.
Cabin essence, man. Yeah, live it, learn it, love it. What have you been consuming, Nick, besides psilocybin this morning?
So, no, not at all. But I think I'm going to talk about Ketamine the Musical next week, because I was like, I saw that on, I don't know, Friday or Saturday. I was like, oh, I'm talking about that. And it's fucking fantastic. And then I went to see Moon Age Daydream yesterday with Reason's art director, Joanna Andreasen. And it is a documentary about the life and work of David Bowie that is absolutely fantastic. It's by Brett Morgan, who also did The Kid Stays in the Picture and Kurt Cobain, Montage of Heck. This, I will say, as somebody involved in documentary filmmaking, it is a different way of doing like a biographical documentary that is just brilliant and mind-blowing, inspiring. I mean, it's like, I just think about it and I'm deeply, deeply moved by it. For people who are not David Bowie super fans, and it helps if you are, but you don't have to be one, there is a, what it drives home is how to talk about like counterfactuals or how society ends up the way it is. It captures brilliantly how fucking weird David Bowie was when he emerged in the early 70s as Ziggy Stardust and as like an outer space rock star, you know, with kind of fascistic tendencies. And there's a moment in a concert from like 73 or 74 where he's doing the song, The Gene Genie, with a great backing band. And then it breaks down into him singing Love Me Do by the Beatles. And this, the songs are apart by about a decade, and the Beatles reshaped the world, you know, in a phenomenal way. And a decade later, Bowie, who is wearing like a crocheted one-legged one piece, you know, Afghan, I don't even know what the fuck to call it, like a onesie, and is so bizarre and just shot us off into outer space. And like, you know, I've been thinking about him as like the, you know, he's the embodiment of the weirdification of the world in a great way, like in terms of self-expression, in terms of community, in terms of art, in terms of mutation, as just, it's fantastic. So I can keep slobbering over it, but go see Moon Age Daydream, the new documentary about David Bowie by Brett Morgan, because it's also inspiring. The big thing is that Bowie, like one of his idols, Andy Warhol, showed up every day to do fucking work. Like for all the drug taking and all the weirdness and everything, he got up every morning and put in, you know, 8 to 15 hours of work at his craft all the way till the very end. And he also, like, his final album is just stunning because he knew he was dying and he wrapped it all up in a bow. It's just, it's beautiful. A fantastic movie that everybody should see, Moon Age Daydream.
Speaking both of the frontier of Peter Sudermann and verklempt middle-aged men, I saw Lewis and Clark, The Journey of the Core of Discovery, watched it, a two-part Ken Burns documentary series that came out in 1997, got there because of my seven-year-old, really is into Sacagawea. I'm mispronouncing that, but I'm not going to pronounce it correctly. It's too difficult. Which she got into because of, obviously, the Night at the Museum series. So she read the Who Was Sacagawea and wanted to see some kind of documentary about it. She was a little disappointed that it wasn't a documentary about Sacagawea, because Sacagawea is pretty awesome, although she plays an important role. But I was very happy to, I didn't know that this documentary existed. It's Ken Burns, you know, it's going to be Ken Burns. So with everything that comes with what you expect from a Ken Burns documentary, boom, two-parter, obviously Hal Holbrook and Sam Waterston, because you weren't going to do that without them. I ended up being very, very moved, particularly by the second one. I didn't expect to be really. It's just, you know, everyone ambiently kind of knows the story of Lewis and Clark. Jefferson sends them out to investigate the newly acquired Louisiana Purchase. We didn't really know what was on the other side of the banks of the Mississippi River, and especially the Missouri River, which they crawl up to, and they try to find a way, and eventually do, to the Pacific Ocean and the Columbia River. Because I have family connections and long personal history with the Columbia Gorge and all that, that part in particular was very moving. Also, Meriwether Lewis is a manic depressive, and there's a moment that where they sort of talk about his journal entry when he reaches the age of on his 31st birthday, when he's literally writing it on the Continental Divide, which he's just discovered. And he's this very melancholy, self-questioning about whether he's really added anything of value to history and the transmission of knowledge. And it's just kind of devastating to imagine and to think about. And the Dayton Duncan is one of the great historians who's assembled there. And like, he can't, the magnitude of it, he can't quite even convey. It's tremendous. There's also a lot of sadness and kind of preemptive of doom associated with the fact that they're just going, and the only people who lived there were Native American tribes in most every place that they went to, and it's just it's a damn dirty shame. There was a moment that they could have been ended, this whole trip and a lot of other things besides with it, but there, by the grace of generosity by Native American tribes who were then afterwards didn't work out so great for them. But it's just, it's very moving and interesting. If you haven't seen it before, Stephen Ambrose is just awesome. Just this salty dog talking about it. And William Least Heat, who was a writer I'd forgotten about, but it was really great.
Blue Highways.
Back in the 80s and 90s. Really great book. But anyways, check it out. Lewis and Clark, The Journey of the Corps of Discovery. It's available on your PBS documentary, Amazon type of channel. So go do it. All right. That's all the Frontier.
Is that channel 30 or channel 31? I forget.
28. It's always 28. Forever 28 is my new line of audiovisual discovery. Go to all of our podcasts at reason.com/podcasts. Go to all our Here Give Us Money at reason.com/donate. And we will see you next week. Goodbye.